Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholars Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Henry Strozier, and I'll be your host. Today, we begin a course entitled Wars That Made the Western World, the Persian Wars, the Peloponnesian War, and the Punic Wars. Your professor is Timothy B. Schutt of Kenyon College. Professor Schutt earned his B.A. in English Literature at Yale and his Ph.D. in Medieval Literature and the History of Ideas at the University of Virginia. Since 1986, Professor Schutt has taught at Kenyon College, where he has taught in the English department and in the college's unique Integrated Program in Human Studies, an interdisciplinary program which focuses on the great books of literature, philosophy, history, art history, religion, and science. In addition to numerous academic publications, Schutt has also written extensively on military history, baseball, and birding. The values of a civilization undergo their most intense trial by fire when they are exposed to the inferno of war. In the deadly battles between cities, states, and countries, ideas, beliefs, and virtues either collapse or emerge triumphant, as one culture overcomes or submits to another. The Western world, for all its history of bloody combat, was forged in its most fundamental particulars thousands of years ago in a series of wars that shaped and defined the civilizations of the Greeks and the Romans, and thus in turn molded and influenced the shape of our identity, even today, as Westerners. In this course, we'll examine the three pivotal engagements that most determined the early course of history. We'll look at the Persian Wars, fought between the Greek city-states and the massive Persian Empire. The Peloponnesian War, where the Greek city-states turned against each other. And finally, the Punic Wars, the apocalyptic series of conflicts between Carthage and Rome that ended with the emergence of Rome as a growing imperial power. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin Wars That Made the Western World, Lecture 1, The Persian Wars, Greece and Persia, The Opening Rounds. And now, Professor Schutt.
Welcome to Wars That Made the Western World. In this course, we're going to take a look at three monumental contests that took place in antiquity. That is to say, BC, and pretty much every date that we discuss in these lectures is going to be BC or BCE. The first was between the Persian Empire and a fragile coalition of Greek poleis, or city-states, the Greco-Persian Wars, which began, of course, the causes and antecedents go before that, but in hardcore terms in 490 and lasted till 479, again BCE. And then in the aftermath of that, the war for dominance of at least the eastern Mediterranean, if not the whole of it, between the two leading players on the Greek side in the Persian Wars, the very different poleis of Athens and Sparta, which resulted finally, a bit after the war, though the war was an immense contributing factor, in something close to the political collapse of both Athens and Sparta as first-rate political powers. Finally, who succeeded them in the end? In the short term, it was Alexander and the Macedonians, but ultimately, it was Rome. And we'll take a look at the war which made of Rome the dominant Mediterranean power, the dominant power of the Western world, a position which it would go on to hold for well more than half a millennium. And that is the series of Punic Wars against the North African trading city and empire of Carthage. These last the bloodiest and costliest and in some sense most highly contested wars of antiquity and indeed, at least arguably, until the 20th century. Our format in this lecture will be first to take a look at exactly how a series of wars which happened at least 2,000 years ago can be said to have made the Western world. We'll then take a look at our sources for the first of these conflicts that we're going to address, the Persian Wars, and then we'll take a look at the players, sort of a lineup card to see what the Persian Empire was like and where it came from, and we'll at least begin to discuss what the Greek polis were like as well. Well, it's not self-evident, to put it mildly, how a series of events that took place at the earliest, 2,100 plus years ago, can be said to have a continuing, and not just continuing, but indeed a decisive effect on how we conceive of ourselves now. How can such a thing be? How did they make the Western world? Well, the answer to that, as I see it, is not only did the wars determine who is going to dominate the Mediterranean cultural hearth, which is where Western culture ultimately comes from, also they represent the occasion when a self-conscious sense of cultural difference, and this has its toxic side effects, no doubt about it, as we are well aware now, but nonetheless, a sense of cultural difference, a sense that we are, not just because we're us, but because our way of life is different, because what we focus on is different. For all sorts of reasons, we are different from, the West is different from, we Hellenes, ultimately we Greco-Romans, ultimately we Westerners, are different from, in what we value, those who are outside the line. Again, this is a kind of a vexatious concept. It goes back, not to get too fancy about it, as far as I can tell, to the Prussian philosopher of the early 19th century, who has the wonderful name of Georg Friedrich Wilhelm Hegel. Hegel, lecturing at Berlin, who claims that we define who we are by differentiating ourselves from an other, from somebody else. To take an obvious example, we look at, say, a cat and say, well, I don't have fur, I don't purr, I sometimes like to eat vegetables, a whole series of differences. Hence, I am not a cat, much as I might like cats. In a more highly loaded cultural context, the West looks at people outside the boundaries of what's conceived as the West and says, well, gee, you know what? They practice human sacrifice, which, in fact, the Persians didn't, but the Phoenicians did, and regularly. They do X, Y, or Z, whatever it may be. They are not like us, and of course, in every case ever known to me, you can think back to various Western movies of the past 20 years, which show things from the Native American side, and of course, Native Americans don't call themselves Indians, but call themselves in pretty much all known instances something which translates as the human beings or us or the nice people, and the outsiders in most cultures have names that mean something like the stinkers or the hairy people or the bad folks or something like that. I mean, this is just a cultural universal, a sad one, but so it is. Nonetheless, these wars, the Persian Wars in particular, were instrumental in formulating a sense of Westernness as a cultural touchstone. Westernness is an instance of who we are. A Palestinian who taught for a long time at Columbia, who recently died, named Edward Said, more or less inaugurated what is now known as the whole discipline of neocolonial studies with a book called Orientalism, which claims something which I would value it differently, but I would be inclined to support, which is that the West is defined over against as different from what he calls the Orient, which is to say the East, which is to say in this original and prototype instance, the Persian Empire. And the way it's formulated right from the outset, when it becomes a concept to which people give allegiance, which people have formulated for themselves, is we Westerners are free, we Westerners are subject to the rule of law, we're also brave and tough, but that's not quite as central. There's plenty of brave and tough Orientals, too, to use the dislogistic term. And the folks that are on the other side of the line are enslaved, are subject to autocratic governments, and are not subject to law. They're subject to whim, the whim of the ruler. And thus, fighting for our freedom is something worth doing. That, however compromised we may feel about making dismissive judgments of other cultures, is something that we still do believe as Westerners, that we are free in thought, in speech, in our political activities, more or less, and subject to the rule of law. And that is something very much worth fighting for in opposition to tyranny. That conceptualization of the West begins with the Persian Wars, reaches full articulation with the Persian Wars. It fired up the Greeks to victory, and it was a long-shot victory, as we'll see, and it's still very much with us to this day. It's revealing, this is kind of a cultural chestnut, people say this all the time, but it's true for all that. This attitude is revealed sort of in a state of suspension before it crystallized by the Greek word for people who were not Greek. The Greek word for themselves was Hellenes. The word for non-Hellenes was Barbaroi, barbarians. And notoriously, it is an insulting and deliberately insulting evocation of the way people who don't talk Greek but talk some dumb other language sound, which is bad, 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 bad. The Greeks, by the way, this is kind of interesting and different from now. We have some misgivings about our unquestioned or more or less unquestioned sense of cultural superiority. The Greeks had virtually none of that. Very few Greeks bothered to learn other languages, and those who did so unwillingly, subject to pressing circumstances, and badly. We'll have occasion as we proceed to see what the Greeks did to the various foreign names they encountered. Anyway, enough on that. We'll have occasion to return to it. It's time now to take a look at our sources for the Persian War, which are fortunately extensive and of very high quality, though some have argued otherwise. Herodotus of Halicarnassus, which is was a city in what is in effect the southwestern corner of the Anatolian Peninsula in what's now Turkey. It was then very much Greek, Ionian Greek, as it happens, culturally. Herodotus of Halicarnassus, who was born in the mid-480s, at about the time of the Persian Wars, undertook a series of what he called historia, that is to say, investigations. Our word history descends from it, of the war, as he thought of it, between the Greeks and the barbarians. This is interesting in several respects. First, it is the earliest surviving history which we have. He essentially invented the genre. We've lost the works of a predecessor of his called Hecataeus, who had a more geographical focus, and how much he actually owed to Hecataeus, of course, in the absence of Hecataeus, is hard to say. But for our purposes, and likely in substantial measure in any case, history quite literally begins with Herodotus. You can say, it's a curious thing to say, but you can say in some sense that the world before Herodotus is prehistoric. There are annals and king lists in other cultures, but not the sort of analytic effort to reconstruct the past and to see what the past reveals about the present. Because for Herodotus, in a deep sense, Self-consciousness is historical consciousness. You can't know who you are unless you know where you've come from. And that whole notion of formulating who we are and of studying our past as a means of coming to know what we value, what we focus on, that too stems from Herodotus. He also, just a little plug here, has a lot of other virtues. He is not only the founder of history, father of history. Some skeptics in the past, more than the present, called him also father of lies because he's a fabulous storyteller, enjoys telling stories, and some of the stories are a little spectacular. But as time has gone on, archaeology has confirmed more and more of these spectacular stories. So rather to the surprise of contemporary experts, so he is no longer so much the father of lies, but more the father of comparative anthropology, because he writes with fascination and firsthand knowledge about Egypt at length, and also about Scythia, which is what the Greeks called the area of Central Asia and southern Russia and Ukraine, which was inhabited by fierce, gold-loving, nomadic horse people, some of whose women supposedly fought regularly, and evidently the legends of the Amazons come from that context. Most of our knowledge about the Persian Wars comes from Herodotus, but we have actually some even earlier testimony and testimony of high value. Most Greek tragedies, as you know, deal with mythological subjects, whether they be the House of Thebes, Cleon and Antigone, or the House of Argos, Agamemnon, and so forth. But not all. Aeschylus, for my money the greatest of the Greek dramatists, wrote and had performed in 472, 8 years after the event, a play called The Persians, which is about the Persian reaction to the Persian Wars. And Aeschylus was in a good position to know what had happened. He had fought in the opening round battle of Marathon in person, rather than his dramatic career. It was his role at the Battle of Marathon that he chose to have commemorated on his epitaph. His brother died at Marathon, and he later fought at the naval battle of Salamis. So he knew whereof he spoke, and we have that evidence as well. Well, now it's time to turn to the players. You can't tell the players without the scorecard, and here's a scorecard of sorts. Persia. At the time of the Persian War, Persia was the biggest empire that we know of that had ever been in the world. It was huge. It went from effectively just across the Hellespont from modern Istanbul in Turkey all the way down through Egypt and west all the way to the borders of India in Afghanistan. Huge. The heartland, of course, was what we now call Iran. And that's where the Medes, or Medes, and the Persians originally came from the mountainous areas of Iran. This may be a good moment, in fact, as we begin to address a series of Persian names and various other Middle Eastern names, to confront head-on a problem which will be with us the whole way through this course. And that is, to the best of my knowledge, there is no agreed-upon, universally accepted way of pronouncing a lot of these names. And bear with me on this digression, because if you have ever watched shows about this time on TV, if you've ever heard other recordings or lectures on this, you will notice that people say the same name different ways. The reason for that is essentially this. Our sources are almost entirely Greek. We have very few, not zero, but very few Persian sources. And the Greeks transliterated, rather inattentively, foreign names which they encountered. Then the Latins, the Romans, took the Greek names and Latinized them, and then we have anglicized often both the Latin and the Greek names. So you got a lot of choices. You can choose to pronounce it as close as you can to how the original tongues, if it's a non-Greek or Roman name, pronounced it. You can pronounce it Greek. You can pronounce it modified Greek. You can pronounce it Roman. You can pronounce it modified Roman. Up until the 19th century, the British pronounced Latin differently than we do now. And there are all sorts of variations in between. So if I say these names differently than you've heard, I'm making a choice. Other people make different choices. Don't be disturbed. When the Persian Empire began, though, huge empire though it became, they were by no means, they were anything but the first empire in the area. Civilization, meaning urbanization based on extensive, in early instances, irrigation and agriculture, began, so far as we can tell, in Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in the Near East, in short. And the Persians had, this is really hard to believe, but it is true, the Persians had as much urban life and civilization behind them when they took over as we do with regard to the Persians. There was already ancient history, and it was thought of as ancient history when the Persians took over. It began supposedly in Sumer, right near the area around Basra in the Persian Gulf, starting, depending on how you want to count it, on how you want to slice it, whether it's extensive agriculture or cities or records or whatever, somewhere between 4500 BCE and 3100 BCE, back then, and it lasted till about 2000 BCE. The Sumerians fought in very primitive-looking, by at least the little models that they made, chariots. It was not so much an empire as a confederation of, or anti-confederation of cities, some of whom got along together some of the time, some of whom did not. They were, in any case, overthrown by Babylon in the early second millennium, that is the one whatever hundreds BCE, and the Babylonian state under the ruler Hammurabi or Hammurabi became very, very influential indeed. The laws of Hammurabi or Hammurabi, this is one of those instances I was talking about where their different pronunciations are preserved and influential to this day. Meanwhile, you have the Hittites, an Indo-European rather than Semitic-speaking group, from about 1850 BCE to 1200 BCE up in the area of eastern Anatolia and environs, that is to say eastern Turkey, eastern contemporary Turkey. And then from about 1300, you get yet another state, the fiercest and most frightening, at least from my perspective of all of them, Assyria. They were absolutely ferocious warriors, the best warriors that had ever existed thus far, and in rather unsavory ways, as their art reveals. They made use of terror as a weapon. If you were captured by the Assyrians, that was a pretty regrettable situation. Their heyday came about, 745 maybe to 605 under rulers who have come down to us, among other places in the Bible, Tiglath-Pileser II and Sargon and Sennacherib and the like. They, however, were finally defeated by a revived Babylon, Babylon II, you could call it, at the Battle of Carchemish in 605. And then, and now we're getting close to the Persian Empire, Babylon was the predominant power in the region. Meanwhile, a little bit further east in the Indus Valley was a series of urban civilizations going on, but we don't know too much about the contacts between the two. The remains, in terms of records, for those Indus Valley civilizations tend to be a little spottier, and they seem not to have been direct contributors to the story before us in this course, in the sense that these ancient Near Eastern civilizations were. In any case, after 605, the dominant player was Babylon. All of the groups that we have talked about controlled the Mesopotamian heartland. Hot, dry, but because of irrigation from the Tigris and Euphrates, fertile for all that. Really hot, by the way. Hot as Phoenix, hot as Las Vegas, 110 degrees plus in the summer, blazing hot. The Persians and the Medes came from the mountains to the north. They were not plains people, just as the Assyrians had come from the north before them. And they were less culturally sophisticated, at least originally, than the cities of the plain, so to speak. Our story begins with one of the truly luminous figures of antiquity. You know he's a luminous figure because even his opponents and the people whom he overwhelmed have very little that is bad to say about him. Cyrus of Persia. His name in Persian was Koresh or Koresh. The Greeks Hellenized that into Kyrus. That gets Latinized into Kyrus, and it gets Anglicized into Cyrus, and it says Cyrus that we know him. He became a sort of semi-legendary figure, and he took control of the Persians sometime around 560-559. A lot of ancient dates are in that slashed form, largely because various people started the year at various times. So we'll hear that something was in this year, but it's like a school year, which runs from, you know, summer to summer rather than from winter to winter. In any case, 559, 560, he takes over. By 550, he had taken over the realm of the Medes as well, taking it, in fact, from his grandfather, who was a pretty fierce character, and the Medes and the Persians were united. Still, not a real powerhouse joint. Nonetheless, Cyrus then embarked on a series of conquests, and this is where Herodotus begins his story, most notably over the kingdom of Lydia, which is how the Greeks got involved. Lydia, with its capital at Sardis, was ruled by Croesus, of rich as Croesus fame. Croesus was purportedly the richest man in the world, and in fact, the first recorded coins come from Lydia. Part of the realm of Lydia consisted of Greek-speaking and culturally Greek Aegean islands on the Turkish coast. And Cyrus conquered Lydia after Croesus had invaded. Croesus, before he invaded, in a very famous story, had consulted the Delphic Oracle, the most influential oracle in the ancient world in Delphi in Greece, or Delphi in Greece, as to what would happen if he invaded Persia. He was told a great empire would fall. Well, it did. His. And there's various stories in Herodotus about what happened. Supposedly he was about to be burned as a prisoner, but there was divine intervention and he became a wise advisor to Cyrus. Stories differ. But in any case, at that moment, Persia took over control of Lydia and with it, of a lot of Ionian, that is to say, island area Greeks. Afterwards, in 539-38, he conquered Babylon. And it was then that Persia began to become something resembling the Persian Empire, which I've already begun to discuss. And that Babylonian conquest, is notable for us culturally in biblical terms because it was Cyrus's enlightened policy to send refugees that he had conquered back where they came from. And among the refugees in Babylon was a small group from the Mediterranean coast and just inland, the Jews. And he sent them back to Israel, the remnant that was in Babylonia, where they refounded the temple. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Your iniquity is pardoned, and so on and so on. Isaiah 40. Lots of cultural resonances there. Cyrus died trying to extend his conquest to the north into Central Asia, fighting a group of folks whom Herodotus calls the Massagetae, who were culturally very similar to the Scythians, and he met his end then. Well, what was the Persian Empire like as established by Cyrus and as described by Herodotus? The answer is it was autocratic, of course. Herodotus claims that in essence, everybody, however high his or her social position, was in effect the slave of the king, which sounds horrifically oppressive. But in fact, that sort of social arrangement was nothing new in the area, and certainly in comparison to their predecessors, the Persians were pretty benign. Witness the fact that they sent Israel back to Jerusalem, sent the Jewish population, the Hebrew population, back to the Promised Land. They ordinarily kept in power local rulers who were again inclined to rule with a light touch unless there was a rebellion or unless the taxes weren't paid. That was what they cared about. The Greeks called these local rulers satraps. The actual Persian word was kshatrapavan, which the Greeks metamorphosed into satrap. And the satraps had a good deal of independent power. They were finally subject to the great king, the basileus, as the Greeks called him. But they were very influential folks, and it was often they who intervened most directly in at least some phases of the Persian Wars and the wars that followed. The religion's worth talking about a little bit, too. It's called Mazdaism, and it hypothesizes an ongoing cosmic battle between the Lord of Light, the forces of good, Ahura Mazda, and his rival, leading the forces of darkness, Ahriman. And it was presided over by a group of priests who were called magi. And the word magus, the gift of the magi, all of that constellation of tradition comes from Mazdaism. And some people have argued even that the notion of hell may come from Mazdaism, associated with the figure of Ahriman and the notion of an evil force of very nearly equal power, contesting for the universe in a cosmic battleground. In any case, after the death of Cyrus, his son, Cambyse, known to the Greeks as Cambyses, took over. He succeeded in conquering Egypt in 525 BCE, and then we get a direct player. After his death, there was a coup d'etat, palace intrigue, and the person, a relative, but not the son of Cambyses, took over, and his name was Daraya, or Darayavosh, known to the Greeks as Darius or Darius. And he ruled very effectively, and he ruled for a long time, and it was he who came directly into conflict with the Greeks. He ruled from 522 to 486, fought in Ionia in the early 510s, went up to Scythia not by the Caspian route that Cyrus had taken, but going around the Black Sea through what's now Romania, building a big bridge over the Danube. That didn't turn out so well. He had to retreat. He didn't succeed in conquering the Scythians either. The Scythians evidently were pretty hard to conquer. You wouldn't think so. I mean, being a nomad group and all of the rest, and other than metalworking and horsemanship at what seems to be a relatively low cultural level. But they proved formidable opponents, and in truth, nobody who wasn't a mounted archer succeeded in conquering those areas until the invention of gunpowder, so he was perhaps ill-advised to take these folks on. The folks in Lydia, however, and the Ionians in particular, the Greeks and the Greek-speaking islands, were not entirely happy. And in 499, after Darius had been in control for about 23 years, there was a revolt in Ionia, prompted not so much by a sense of injustice, but as a grievance against excessive taxation. And here's where the story moves towards its central focus for us. The Athenians, being Ionic speakers themselves, there were various Greek dialects, sent an expedition to help their kinsfolk, the Ionians, in their rebellion. And in 498, the Athenians and others burned the capital of the satrapy now of Lydia at Sardis. That was going too far. The Athenians soon realized they were going too far and pulled out of the expedition and went home, but it was too late to make a difference. By 493, the Persians had squelched the rebellion, and according to Herodotus, Darius was so angry at the Athenians for stepping into a quarrel that at least arguably was not theirs, they hadn't been conquered by Persia, that Herodotus claims that he designated a servant to remind him three times before every dinner, "Master, remember the Athenians. Master, remember the Athenians. Master, remember the Athenians." They had ticked off the wrong guy. Trouble was brewing. And Darius planned an invasion. And his demand was that all Greeks submit to him or face his wrath, and not just his wrath, but his military power, which was very considerable, Scythians to the contrary. He sent to the various poleis, about which we'll talk in just a second in Greece, messengers, demanding that they give as a sign of submission earth and water, signify Darius's control over their entire polis. Lots gave earth and water. The Persian Empire overwhelmingly outnumbered any polis, and indeed any coalition of polises that was possible, or polis that was possible. Athens and Sparta, however, took a different course. As Herodotus says, Athens threw Darius's messengers into a pit where they threw condemned criminals. They died. I presume they were killed beforehand, but that's not entirely clear, but they certainly were killed. The Spartans, puckishly, threw the messengers down a well and said, "Hey, lots of earth and water down there, pals. Get all you want." They died too. This, as you might imagine, did nothing to mitigate Darius's wrath, and he set up a punitive expedition to sail in 490 against the Greeks in particular, and the Athenians and the Spartans above all. Greece, unlike Persia, was not an empire, was anything but an empire, was nothing really like an empire in the sense of unified political control of the whole region until the conquests of Alexander in the 330s, and later, of course, under Rome. Instead, it was formed of poleis, of a whole series of what we will call in English polises, city-states. And there were about 1,000 of them. Now think, Greece, right, is not that big a country even today. I mean, its population is on the order of a big Midwestern state or thereabouts. Divide that by 1,000, you've got lots and lots of small, independent, fiercely competitive statelets in a state of sort of constant envious carping rivalry. They were poor, or poorish by Persian standards for sure, not lots of gold there. They were independent, and they were chronically quarrelsome. It would eventually prove their undoing. Once again, there were 1,000 or more of them, but a handful proved long-term more influential than the others. There was Argos in the Peloponnese, or Argos. There was Syracuse, the colony in Sicily, and the biggest city in Sicily. There was Thebes, home of Oedipus, just to the north of Athens on the Boeotian Plain, and there was wealthy Corinth in the Gulf of Corinth, right on a little isthmus leading to the Peloponnese, with the Aegean on one side and again the Gulf of Corinth on the other, renowned for wealth. And of course, there were the most influential of all, Athens and Sparta, and we'll take a closer look at them as we begin our next lecture.
This ends Lecture 1.